Have one Russian, Alexandra Skarnov, and then you're going to have the Luca Pomitano. Pomitano is from Italy, and he's been up there, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, and he's the guy that was doing an EVA and had problems with his suit. He wound up with water in his helmet, almost causing him to actually drown in space. Filter on a suit got clogged, and he built up pretty quickly inside of an hour and a half, only in EVA, a lot of water, which terminated the that particular EVA. Eventually, they brought the suit back and figured out what the problem was. So he's going up again. Nothing scares these guys, that's for sure. They can't wait until they get another launch, along with an American, Andrew Morgan. I believe he's going to be a long-term astronaut, probably getting close to a year on that, on his flight, because he's going up with this crew and he's not coming back. When the crew does come back next year, they'll be bringing Christina Koch back instead. She's up there now, and she's going to be up there for almost a year herself. So they're continuing with long-duration missions. It helps them two respects to have that. You get a lot more data for medical purposes for eventually long flights to Mars. But it also helps in the launching of these astronauts to the space station, since we still don't have the ability to launch our own people to the ISS. I mean, it's coming up, but we're still not doing it. And until it's done, we're paying Russia now up to $80 million. Talk about Russia. $80 million per person. Years ago, I remember, was around $20 million. And the number just kept going higher and higher as they realized we have problems in getting our rockets eventually to fly people. So that's a story on Soyuz 59S mission coming up on July 20th. The 21st, the day after, you have a SpaceX launch to the ISS. And that's going to be their the 20th flight to the space station from by SpaceX on a Falcon 9 rocket. They'll be launching from Launch Complex 40 in Florida. SpaceX has two launch complexes in Florida. They have Launch Complex 40, and then they have Launch Complex 39A, which they took over years ago. 39A is the one that was used for all the Apollo missions to the moon. It was also used for a little over half the amount of space shuttle flights that took off. So they now control that pad. They will eventually be launching a crew from that pad. They're able to do that hopefully maybe by the end of this year. They might give a shot with a crew of two. Depends on their ability to figure out what went wrong with the explosion that they had back in April on the pad when the crew vehicle exploded. Didn't kill anybody, but they were tested with the forces and that failed. And I still haven't figured out if they have figured the problem out yet. Sure that if not, it's going to be a while before they actually can launch a crew in space on the Falcon 9 rocket. Okay, 4th of July just went by, and that was normal year, not too much fireworks, but seems like on 4th of July, for NASA anyway, there's a lot of anniversaries that come up around that time. For instance, that's the time that the Juno spacecraft went into orbit around Jupiter. 22 years ago, Sojourner and Pathfinder arrived on Mars. Pathfinder landed with the Sojourner rover on board. Sojourner was about the size of a microwave oven. It was small, had six wheels, it had solar panels. It landed with airbags, bounced along the surface of Mars. Eventually, they opened up the pedals, and out came Sojourner, and they rode around on Mars for almost 3 months. They were hoping to get 7 days out of it. like most of NASA's missions. A lot of them are delayed, very hard to get off the ground, scrub after scrub. But some of these deep space missions land on these planets, they start orbiting around planets, and they get, you know, one extension after the other. And the next you know, it's 20 years later, and they're still working. Well, that worked out, you know, very good for Sojourner and the Pathfinder. And it was a proof of concept type of thing. They built bigger ones, Spirit and Opportunity, the size of a golf cart. And they were launched in 2004 based on the Sojourner system. In fact, they bounced along the surface, too, with these gigantic airbags. Came to a rest. Eventually, the vehicles themselves drove away. All the equipment on board with the robotic arm and all. Sojourner was pretty good. I mean, it had a spectrometer system on there, neutron spectrometer, so they were able to tell what the rocks were made of. It had cameras, so, you know, you could transmit signals back where it was going. The Pathfinder itself had a weather station on board. You know, that stayed behind as the robo drove away. And Pathfinder was able to take pictures of the rover, for instance. Eventually, they changed the name of Pathfinder. They gave Carl Sagan the honor, and they renamed Pathfinder the Carl Sagan Memorial Station. So that was July 4th, 22 years ago. We drive it. Of course, we have Curiosity driving around on Mars now. It's going to be joined by Mars 2020. And if China has their way, they plan on putting a rover on Mars during the same year as us. And in fact, the European Space Agency has a rover that they've been designing, and they hope to launch with Russia also in the same time frame. You know, we'll get there first. China and the European Space Station will get there later, but if all goes well, at that time, by the time all is done, there'll be four rovers riding around on Mars. That'll be pretty good. I mean, we don't have people there, but we've had plenty of rovers and plan on having some more of humanity. Talking about Mars, the Mars InSight mission, which landed last year, started talking about the probe test that was supposed to drill itself or bang itself into the surface. Last week I kind of ran out of time, but right now, the engineers are taking a look at that and what went wrong with that problem. InSight is a lander, not a rover, just stayed in one spot. And the idea is to check out earthquakes and to check out, when I say earthquakes, Marsquakes, and to check out other things that go on the inside of Mars, including the temperature. They had this mold that was going to pound itself into surface, about 14 inches long. It's got a weight inside, and it's got this electric motor that turns up against the tension of a spring. And every time it gets to a certain point, the spring gets released. Weight forces itself down. Now, this is internal in the mold because it hits the inside of the mold on the head of it. It's supposed to drive itself into the surface. They would like to go down about 15 feet and drag a heat line behind it or be able to take measurements as it goes down. By doing it as they go down, they could extrapolate and eventually find out, you know, how hot it is way down deep in the surface of Mars. Unfortunately, that failed. It started hammering its way in, and they felt it got about halfway in and stopped, and they think it was on an angle. So the engineers got together, and they have a test bed here at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. And they ran some tests, and they were able to determine that this thing has probably either hit a rock that's going on an angle, or what they think most likely is that the surface is a little softer than they predicted. It's got a soft surface. The mold is starting to drill itself in, or bang itself in. Drill is actually a bad word. It makes it seem like it's spinning, but it's actually hammering itself in. And the way it was supposed to work is as it's hammering itself down in, it's got this carriage around it that's holding it originally. and, you know, lining up to go down straight. And as it was going in, they think the surface is too soft and it doesn't have enough friction on the outside of the mold to hold it. And every time it hammers itself in, it's kind of like bouncing back and forth and not going anywhere. So the engineers duplicated what they wanted to do, and it worked on California at JPL. They took the robotic arm and lifted this whole carriage contraption off away from the mold. There's pictures on the internet. You know, you can get them from NASA showing this. Actually, they beat it up the camera, so it looks like it's moving quick. The arm grabbing this carriage and pulling it away from the surface, and the mold now sticking into ground on a bit of an angle. So the idea is to near future, they're going to, you know, spend a lot of time. This takes like forever to do, but they're going to take the robotic arm and press the dirt right next to the mold, and by compressing the dirt, that soil will have enough friction, and this thing might start pulling its way in. Once it gets down deep enough, you know, completely inside the ground, then it would have definitely enough friction, and it would be able to keep going. So the only problem would be is if there's a rock, and they can't do anything about it. They can't pull the mold out and relocate it. They don't have that capability. There's no grabby thing on top of the mold to do that. All hope will be lost if this idea doesn't work, of creating friction next to the mold. So if it all works, the heat probe, the heat flow and physical property package, it's called HP3. You put an HP3 inside in the internet, you can come up with all this information. They have listed, let me drop it, this WS2S. Okay, I just want to get to the test that NASA did recently, the ascent and abort number 2 test, which launched out of Launch Complex 46 down in Florida, and this happened last week on Tuesday, July 2nd. They had a window to test this launch abort system between 7 o'clock and 11 o'clock. Sure enough, it went off exactly on time at 7 o'clock in the morning. The idea was to test to see if this launch abort system would be able to pull an Orion crew vehicle, which would eventually have four people inside, away from a booster that was failing. So they've tested this on the pad before, you know, as if there was an explosion on the pad a couple of years back. They tested that, and that was successful. The abort system was able to pull the crew vehicle away. But they need to test it in flight. They need to test it on the maximum Q. Maximum Q is in atmosphere, usually about 6-7 miles up. And the reason it's maximum pressure is because that's when the vehicle is going at a certain speed, and the atmosphere is at a certain thickness, where you have the most pressure pushing against the vehicle. And you would think it would be down low, 14.7 pounds per square inch ambient pressure here, but it's not. It's when it gets up and it's going through the atmosphere, accelerating, and before you know it, it's up to 1,300 miles an hour, and that's about the time when most of the pressure is on the vehicle. They needed to test to make sure the abort system would work at that point. You know, that would be the worst-case scenario. So what NASA did for this whole project is to get a hold of a Keeper ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile that has been decommissioned. The Peacekeeper missiles no longer are armed and ready to fire. We have other ones called Minutemen, but the Peacekeeper, this one is the SR-118. They have four solid stages, let's put it that way. You have one on top of the other, and they're all solid rocket engine, though. You know, one goes off, the next one goes off. They only needed the first one. Now, this thing produces like 500,000 pounds of thrust. But they needed to borrow one of these, and they did, and they got it. They brought it down into Florida, and they put an Orion spacecraft on top of it, which was a little weird because the diameter of the Orion spacecraft is a little over 15 feet, and the Peacekeeper rocket is only about, you know, 8 feet diameter, so 12 or 7 feet, but we'll call it 8 feet diameter. So they needed to put this, like, cylindrical skirt around it to aerodynamically, you know, make it look like one rocket, so it looks like a big, fat rocket on a launch pad. And you have the Orion spacecraft on top, and then on top of that you have the launch abort system, consisting of three different solid booster type of rocket engines. So it's only a 2.5 minute test, a 3 minute test. The thing is put on a silver, big hole in the ground, and a hole in the ground goes to this flame trench. And so you have basically four ignitions of rockets to test this thing within 3 minutes to see if this launch abort system would be able to pull the Orion away, safely away from the floating booster. So again, like I said before, this thing has 500,000 pounds of thrust. It launched off the Launch Complex 46. Got away safely, and it rose slowly, similar to what would happen with a space launch system that will eventually launch the Orion. Space launch system is going to be, you know, 350 feet high. This whole setup was about 100 feet high, 97 feet, 100 feet high.
W2L repeater.
And I timed out. This whole setup was about 100 feet high. And what happens is first stage lit off at 500,000 pounds. They needed to, you know, it would have taken off like a bottle rocket, you know, so they needed to put ballast in the thing. Ballast, the amount of ballast they put in was 100,000 pounds to slow this solid booster rocket down to duplicate a launch of an SLS rocket. And it did. It slowed it down. It took off and got up to about 6 miles high, around 35,000 feet, and the test was initiated. The abort motors kicked in, one big abort motor, and has four nozzles sticking out on a 45-degree angle, looking down, and pull the Orion spacecraft away from the ICBM, and it pulled it away fast, 500 miles an hour relative to the Peacekeeper. And in fact, that engine puts out 400,000 pounds of thrust, pulls it out, you know, microseconds. And then since that part was successful, they have these other solid booster, engine on the top with eight holes near the point of the vehicle of the launch abort system, and depending on which valves are open, it changed the attitude of, you know, where the spacecraft is. They needed to turn, you know, first they needed to pull the spacecraft away from the booster, because if you had an SLS booster with solid booster rockets, you know, coming up and then do a separation, these booster rockets would be chasing you, you know, they'd catch up to you. So you needed to not only pull it away from the vehicle, but needed to pull it away. And the attitude rocket did exactly that, and it also needs to flip it over once and have it pointing down.
W4YY.
How you doing, Joe? I'm 30 seconds more, guys. So, nevertheless, the jettison motors were next. After it was pointing in a downward position, the jettison motors ignited, pulling the launch abort system away from the Orion vehicle now. And in real flight, that would be the only motor that would ever kick on, because let's say they're going uphill to go into orbit. Everything's fine. Before they get to orbit, they need to pull the launch abort system away from Orion. So at a certain point, the jettison motors come on and do exactly that. Well, they all worked in there. It was all successful. The telemetry was being sent back down to NASA. And they also had these canisters on board, 12 of them that were launched on the way down with the Orion spacecraft. The Orion spacecraft was going to be, you know, dunked into the water and never recovered. So that's the plan. They didn't have parachutes on it. They know the parachutes to work. They've done that many, many times. But the canisters shot out, and they landed in the water. They were a backup system in case they didn't get telemetry. Make a long story short, there was a boat that went around and picked up every single canister, and they got them. In case they didn't get one, they had a phone number and email that if somebody found one, they could always call up NASA. I should go over to Joe. Go ahead, Joe. This is WS1.
Very good. Thanks, Paul. W2YY. Interesting discussion, or actually story you tell her here. My question is simply this. If this escape system on the Orion can instantaneously pull the payload, so to speak, at an accelerated rate of 500 miles an hour faster than the rocket behind it, what does that instantaneously do to the G-forces on the people inside there? I mean, they're being exhibited some sort of G-pressure anyway, going up maybe 3 or 4 G, something like that. What does this instant acceleration do as far as adding G-forces to the human beings? Have they ever measured that?
Yeah, they're going to have to hang on. Yeah, they had the instruments on board for all the measurements, and they estimate that it will be between 5 and 7 G's, most likely probably around 7 G's. It pulls away very quick, and they believe it's somewhere around, I think pilots, jet pilots, can experience 11 G's. Before they start to pass out shows, something like that. So it's within the limits. It's been done only once ever, and that was in Russia back in the 1980s. The launch abort system went off, and it was on a pad, and launched two of the cosmonauts away from the floating rocket, and they got away safely. Back to you, Joe.
Right. Okay. Well, a fighter pilot is wearing a G-suit that has inflatable bladders in certain parts of his body, like the legs and the lower extremities and whatever, to help force the blood from not pooling into the lower part of your body to keep it from, you know, all draining out of your head very quickly. Astronauts aren't wearing that, so what happens then to them? Can they actually survive that kind of instantaneous G-force without having some suit to help compensate for that that change?
Yeah, first of all, of course, they're all bolted in, you know, but good. Yeah, they don't get up to 11 G's, you know, they get up to like 7 max, so they were okay, but, you know, they're going to feel it, and I think it's 3 seconds, that's it, so they just got to hang on and hold your breath for 3 seconds, Joe.
Comment in 1YDY.
Okay, very good, Paul. It's got to be one hell of a ride when that happens.
Yeah, definitely. And by the way, you want to see this thing take off, go to, sent this to Roy, and you can click on it, and it brings up the next button, and then you just scroll down and, you know, hit play, and it's probably one of the coolest 2 minutes to look at watching this, this whole thing do, you know, take off and go through this whole procedure. So if you go to roy.at2gs.com, you'll see it, you know, you'll see the separation, everything, and cameras today are fantastic. And the crew vehicle gets pulled even further. You're at 6 or 7 miles when it happens, and by the time you're done, you're around 8 or 9 miles by the time you actually start coming back down. The other station, go ahead.
Here's N1YDY, and I have a quick comment about G's and the position of the body.
Oh, sure, go ahead. Go right ahead.
I believe that the spine position, the way they sit in the space capsule, because they're not standing or sitting upright, but are rather on their backs, reduces the, or increases their tolerance, reduces the effect of the acceleration forces on their bodies. I read somewhere that F-16, for example, the pilot sits in a fairly lean back or recumbent position for the purpose of reducing the effects of G-forces on him, and that in the base shot that we did in the 60s in both the Apollo and the Gemini, I don't believe it was Mercury, that it was determined that the position of the astronaut on his back stretched out a little bit actually reduced the effects of the acceleration. And one YDY.
W2L repeater.
And one YDY, WS1. Yes, the, I agree, you know, they definitely are taking off with their back flat out on every launch. They did that with the space shuttle. The Russians do it with the Soyuz vehicles. They all had launch abort systems, except for Gemini. Gemini did not have a pusher type or a tractor type. This is the tractor type that we're talking about now. Gemini relied on ejection seats. Space shuttle had nothing, you know. They thought that, you know, this was a reliable system and nothing would happen. You know, if there were problems, they'd be able to, they thought it would happen after the solids were, you know, were out. If the solids were out, they'd be able to separate from the external tank, do one loop around and come back and land back on a runway. That's a 2.5 mile runway at Kennedy. But that of course, proven to be wrong. 73 seconds after Columbia launched, solids were still on, and well, we all know what happened there. Any other comments? Anyway, this thing cost around $300 million or so. That sort of was going to be about $500,000, but they got it down to around a little less than $300 million. But it's quite a system. Crew vehicles that will be going up to the space station don't have this. They have a pusher system, and that's being built. One's being built by SpaceX called Dragon Crew, and then the other one's being built by Boeing called Starliner. That's got a pusher type system, different fuel. They have liquid fuels in those two vehicles, and that's going to push the spacecraft away from the booster in case there's a problem. That's system. Russia has the similar system. They have the launch abort system, tractor system like I just described on their rocket, and they have one extra system that we don't have, is when they get up near where they're about to get into orbit, but not quite, tractor system has been pulled away. You know, the jettison motors come on Soyuz as well, and it pulls away from the Soyuz, and what happens is there's a fairing still, they call it a fairing, still around the Soyuz vehicle. And the fairing has a couple of solid booster motors on it, too, just in case they need to abort as, you know, after the launch abort system has been jettisoned. You know, well, just in case. And sure enough, it saved one of our astronauts' lives. You know, an American... in fact, it's up there now. Hagee is up there now. And the Russian, they were sending two guys up. They got pretty high up. The four boosters, you know, they send the Soyuz up, separated. But one of the boosters inadvertently hit the core stage. That caused all kinds of problems. It triggered an abort. But meanwhile, the launch abort system had already gone away. So the backup system in the fairing, those motors kicked on, pulled the Soyuz spacecraft away from the booster, and sure enough, Rick Hagee and the Russian were saved. And sure enough, they sent the same two guys up along with the third person, and they're up there now in orbit. So in fact, one guy's a ham, and he's already making ham contacts from the space station. So that's the deal with the launch abort system. Any other comments or questions? Okay, I guess not. I was talking to Dick last week about the diameters of the vehicles, these crew vehicles that are going to be up there, and found out the diameter of the Apollo spacecraft was a little less than what I thought. It's 12 foot 10, so it's around 13 feet. But the Orion, which is have eventually four people, Apollo, of course, everybody knows, has three for a crew member. Crew members, the Orion's going to have four, and that's 16 feet diameter for that space vehicle. And Dragon is 12. It's actually a little bit less than the Apollo, and that's going to have the ability to carry four people as well, but it's a little bit taller. It's got a lot more height. It's got 20 feet in height. Apollo only had 10 feet in height. So that's the deal with that. The Starliner is another one that's pretty wide. It's 15 feet in diameter. So it's pretty close to Orion, a little bit less. But interesting with that is it's going to be launched on an Atlas V rocket, which has a much smaller diameter on the Atlas. The Atlas is a couple of feet less than that. It's around 13 or so feet in diameter. So they need to put some kind of a skirt type of cylindrical fairing setup on that to dampen out the aerodynamics. That's the diameters of vehicles. And the one that's least is Soyuz. I think it's only around 8.5 feet or so. It's very small. They managed to squeeze three people into that thing. So that's always an amazing setup to watch those people up go up. They have a orbital module which is attached to them, which is located in front of where they're sitting. So once they get to orbit, they're able to get out of their seats, and they climb through a hatch, and they go to the orbital section where there's a little bit more room to move around. Let me drop it. This is WS2N for ID. Another launch took place from Vostochny, Russia. Vostochny is like right across the area from Alaska, you know. Very close to Alaska, relatively speaking, like 3,000 or 4,000 miles away from Moscow, and they have a whole launch complex set up in Vostochny. The joke is the people from Alaska could see it from there, you know. But it's a bit of ways. It's out in the middle of the woods, there's nothing but trees all over everywhere. They knocked down these gigantic fields and trees. Created a spaceport. The idea is to eventually replace Baikonur. Baikonur is where they launch all the crews from, you know, to the space station now. In fact, all the crews have always been launched from Baikonur, and they plan on moving 3,000 or 4,000 miles to the closest to Alaska to have some launches there. And they've launched four Soyuz vehicles from there, all satellites. And this was the fifth one that got away safely. Launched 33 satellites into polar orbit. Goes north.
W2VL repeater.
I timed that again. Well, nevertheless, the Russians launched a Soyuz vehicle from that launch complex. Got 33 satellites into orbit. And eventually they will be launching crews from that location probably maybe 2, 3, 4 years from now. That's the ultimate goal, to eventually get away from Baikonur. They're tired of paying Kazakhstan money. Kazakhstan, of course, used to be a part of the Soviet Union. Now it's not. Now they got to pay big money for launching rockets from that location. Not too long ago, I was talking about the landing attempt by Israel to launch their vehicle onto the moon. They got pretty far. Launched by SpaceX. They were a secondary mission, but they made it to the moon. It took them like, I don't know, a month or two to finally get there. And they were about to land, and they got close, but they crashed around 400 or 500 miles an hour. Right away they said, oh, we're going to send a Renishit 2 up to the moon, and you know, we got the funding and this and that, and that's all been canceled. apparently they're not going to be doing that anytime soon. No, that's a shame. I mean, they had the capability; they just missed it by that much. And there is one mission that is having some problems. The Discover mission, launched by SpaceX many years ago, into the L1 location, Lagrange Point 1, a million miles between, you know, away from Earth, but between us and the Sun. Essentially, it doesn't really orbit Earth. It just sits between the two as we go around the Sun year after year. And it takes all kinds of measurements of the Sun. Eventually, it was designed to replace the ACE spacecraft, which is actually still functioning. You know, taking measurements of the solar wind and particles. One of its interesting systems was the camera system. I always look back at Earth, look 100% back at the Earth. In fact, you can see the moon going in front of the Earth every now and then. And you always had great pictures. You would Google Discover, and it's not spelled like you think it's spelled there. The DSCOVR. But that mission has some problems, and it's trying to work out the telemetry is not coming back. They're trying to get that back online. They think maybe a cosmic ray or something at the electronics and fried something. Work plan B. A lot of these vehicles have plan B and C. Hopefully that will get back online. I used to, years ago, they tried to launch this back in 2000, and they wanted to call it Triana. The Republicans said, nope, we don't want it. It's going to be looking at the Earth. It's going to convince people of global warming. And so they canceled the mission. They wheeled the thing into storage. Stayed there for many, many years, and eventually they brought it back to life, gave it a new name, put it onto SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, and put it into orbit, and there it stays, 1 million miles away from us. So that's the story. I wonder if anybody has any questions or comments. I have a couple of minor stories, but we're going to be running out of time. Any comments or questions? This is WS2N for the space portion of the Texas. Yes, go ahead, Joe.
Not really a question, it's sort of a comment for you space enthusiasts, you, Paul, and Dick, especially. I don't know if you would be watching Channel 2, but they're going to have a documentary on July 14th, 11:30 a.m., called Apollo 50. I would set up your recording equipment if you have the means to do so. That's going to be this coming Sunday, July 14th, 11:30 a.m. on CBS.
Yeah, thanks for that, Joe. I'll watch that. Apollo 50, that's a good name. 50-year anniversary. And, you know, I'll definitely watch that. I just watched the one that was on CNN not too long ago. That was last week or so. And I recorded that and watched. Very well done. That was archival documentary. Everything you saw and heard was not from the present time. It was all, you know, using real commentaries from Walter Cronkite, you know, the old-time ham friend, and all the film, and they did a whole story of, you know, launching all the way to landing, all the way back. That was pretty good. And I can still get that.
I guess it's a question, is who paid for the revamp of the Apollo mission control room with all the equipment as it was, like, supposedly 50 years ago? I just caught clips of that on the news, and somebody, I guess, I don't know which group or somebody contributed a lot of money, like a couple million dollars to get this place redone so it looked and operational, I guess, partially, like it was 50 years ago. Do you hear anything about that, Paul?
The propagation has changed a whole lot, Paul, and you've completely faded out. You got weaker on the previous transmission, and the last transmission, nothing came through, I'm sorry to say.
Did you hear my transmission, Dick?
Yes, I did.
Mine. New repeater.
Are you now transmitting to Sheldon? Is that what you're doing, Paul?
Yeah, if I knew it was dropping, I would have switched over. I never looked at my receive. I see it's way down. But yeah, nice to have a plan B.
Sure is. Sheldon, sounds good. Okay, we're pretty close to midnight. Any other final comments you want to make, Paul? Joe just asked you who paid for these multi-million dollar upgrades of what I call Building 30 at Houston, which was the Houston Control Center for Apollo. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I saw Gene Kranz. They interviewed him. He was in the room. And they said, I think it was $2 or $3 million, like Joe said. It was donated. Private money came in, and you know, they didn't want to use taxpayer money. They couldn't get taxpayer money to do it. So that, it worked out, and now it's going to become a shrine, I guess. Back to you, Dick.
Because the next week and two is going to be the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 and the moon landing, there's going to be a lot of programs on PBS, CBS, ABC, and so on the subject. So there's going to be quite a bit of Apollo 11 documentaries, as I see it. Thank you for any final comments on this, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
W2L.
Yes, very, yeah. And I try to watch. But there'll be so many, I probably won't be able to watch them all. But very interesting. And then, you know, as time goes on, you're going to have Apollo, you know, 50th anniversary of Apollo, you know, 12, and then, of course, 13, 14, 15. Next couple of years, you'll see stories, I think, relating that to it, but not as much as this. Of course, this is the big one.
Yeah, this is the big one. Okay, 73, you all. Over to Roy if he wants to reissue his addresses one more time. AC2GS, K2RIW. Good stuff. Over to you, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. It's always fun. Once again, for anyone, if you have any mailbag questions that you can't get on to the net and you want to give to Dick, you could email them to me. If you have any questions for my science talk, any topics you'd like me to cover, any subjects you'd like expanded upon, if you want to refute anything I said, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all the links to the story that Paul talked about and a few of the things that I talked about can be found on my website, roy.ac2gs.com. So this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. I thank everyone who participated, and hopefully next week I'll come up with some interesting stuff to talk about as well. So 73, have a great week, and I am clear.
And be careful of those complex numbers. Bye-bye, you all. K2RIW clear.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2L repeater. W2L repeater. W2L repeater. At tonight at 8:30, this is the W2L repeater. At tonight at 8:30, this is the W2L repeater. At tonight at 8:30, this is the W2BL repeater. At tonight at 8:30, this is the W2L repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2L repeater.
W2L repeater. W2L repeater.
morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m. This is the W2L repeater. At tonight at 8:30. This is the W2L repeater. Good morning. The time is 5:03 a.m. This is the W2L repeater. W2L repeater. W2L repeater. W2L repeater. W2L repeater. W2L repeater. At tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2L repeater. Good morning. The time is 6:11 a.m. This is the W2L repeater. Morning. The time is 6:23 a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. W2L repeater. W2L repeater. W2L repeater. At tonight at 8:30, this is the W2L repeater. W2L repeater.